Today is Monday, July 10th, 2006. I am Sandy Fehler, an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Catherine Khalil, Professor of Anatomy in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Hello.
Hi, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. We'll start the interview by having you talk about your early life, where you were born, when you were born, where you went to elementary school, where you went to high school, any people in your early life that had a positive influence you on your career choices later on.
Okay, I spent my formative years in New Jersey and went to elementary and high school there.
What town? Or many towns?
Several towns. I grew up in Pumpkin Plains, which was a little rural sort of town, and then we moved to the suburbs when I was in the middle of high school.
Suburbs of?
New Jersey. Okay. I mean, everything in New Jersey is a suburb of New York, in my opinion.
I see.
So, you know, being near the city was quite interesting for me, and I used to go into the city and visit museums and go to the theater and so forth.
Did you have any, or do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters.
Older, younger?
One older and one younger.
And what did your parents do?
My mother was a patent attorney and has had a, she died recently, at the age of 92, and she had a degree in chemistry and then got a law degree and worked on the Manhattan Project that was responsible for, she was responsible for patenting a number of inventions that were related to, you know, the atomic energy effort. And then subsequent to that, she went to work for Standard Oil and worked on their, in their patent division. My father was a chemical engineer for a chemical company in New Jersey for a long time. Spent his whole career there.
Is he living?
No. He died also at the age of 92, about 5 years ago.
You have a long
life. I have a long life ahead of me. For good or ill.
Did you go to public school?
Yes, I did.
How were the public schools?
Okay.
Any of your teachers that you remember that had particular positive or negative influence on your future studies?
I can't really say that much. I really did not like high school very much for the usual reasons that you might expect. If you weren't popular and went to football games, you could forget high school. And, you know, I did very well and was at the top of my class. And this is very unhelpful to having a good time in high school, I find.
So you knew all along that you would be going to college?
Absolutely. From the time I can even remember, there was no question.
And how did you make the decision as to where to go to college?
Well, I went to Bryn Mawr, small liberal arts school outside Philadelphia, and it was a difficult decision. I had always been interested in science, and I was accepted at MIT, one of only, I think, 25 women who were at that time. And this was 1958, and MIT was a pretty grim place. And I went up to visit, and everybody had slide rules and pocket protectors and long pants up to their waist, like the nerd pictures you see. They looked exactly like that. And I came home and I said I didn't think it was a great idea, and my mother felt like that too. So my older sister at the time was going to Bryn Mawr and just sort of decided to go there.
And did you know that you were going to study science then when you entered Bryn Mawr?
I thought that I was, and actually took a lot of science. I did very well in math and chemistry and physics and biology. And then somehow I got a little sidetracked and had always loved reading and literature, and I wound up being an English major. And then go figure, right? And then I actually then went to graduate school in English. I went to Brown University.
I'm going to back you up a little bit at Bryn Mawr. Now, was that a successful experience? Did you
yes,
like that school?
Very much.
Uh-huh.
It was a small, I think, relatively protected environment, and I would say a very intellectual school where, you know, learning was truly valued. And I had wonderful professors. And one of the best skills I learned there was how to write, which has served me well.
Now, was it a positive thing that your sister was there while you were there?
No.
Oh.
I hate my sister,
oh,
and
dear.
I hate her to this day.
Okay.
And we'll never talk about her again.
Okay. So when you graduated, you you knew you were going down to graduate school, and you said you went to Brown. Now, how did you make that choice?
Sort of mindlessly. I mean, being an English major, there wasn't, I really thought that the ideal life would be to get my PhD in English and come back to a school like Bryn Mawr and teach there and sort of live this very cloistered life, because, you know, the classes were small, it was very idealized. I mean, sometimes we had our classes outside under a tree, and you felt like this sort of Socratic ideal, you know, the acolyte sitting at the foot of the professor. And I thought that would be a really good life. So then I went to Brown and got married and had my first child at the age of 22. Not something I would recommend, but it worked out okay. I've got great children. And then I stayed there, and then...
But now you went to Brown to get a PhD in
correct.
English.
Wait.
Okay.
We're getting there.
Okay.
And I got my master's degree, and I finished most of my PhD, and then I moved to Cambridge, where my husband was, and he was getting a degree in neuroscience at MIT at the time. He was an undergraduate at Harvard. And so I spent 1 year as an instructor at Connecticut College for Women in New London, and I commuted from Cambridge down to New London several times a week, a really terrible experience. And during that year, I realized I could not stand this as a long-term career. I think my joke at the time was, if I have to read papers like Staircase Imagery in Bleak House, ever again I will scream, and nobody is interested in this. I mean, you know, I had a good experience teaching at Connecticut, but I couldn't really see doing that with my life. It was already getting kind of boring. And I was writing my PhD thesis, which in the event I never finished. No great loss for humanity, I would say. It was on George Eliot, which was really quite interesting, mm-hmm. but I just didn't care about it. And then I had my second child, my daughter, right after that year finished. And so during the year, I talked to my husband, and he thought that I would really like neuroscience. And I, you know, used to go to the lab and sit in on experiments and got more and more interested. I'd always loved biology. And really that was kind of my original intention. And English was sort of a long sidetrack. So he persuaded me to apply, and I thought I didn't have a snowball's chance in hell. But I think they were sort of intrigued with the idea of somebody coming back to school in a completely different field.
Now this is applying at MIT?
Yes.
The US?
Oh. Yes. Okay. I mean, I was living in Cambridge anyway.
Sure.
So I interviewed there when I was about 6 months pregnant, and I had a very long sweater on and hoped that nobody would notice, which apparently nobody did. And so, you know, I got in, and then I never went near the place until I had my daughter, because I thought, you know, they were asking me questions like, well, how do you think you're going to go to graduate school? You have a six-year-old. I thought, if you only knew.
Now, were
because
you,
none of the other students were married or had children, nothing.
Were you interviewed by men?
Yes, exclusively. As you can well imagine.
Uh-huh.
This was MIT in 1969. Not what you would call the most enlightened place in the world. Although, you know, I think they treated me quite well, actually.
And your husband at the time was still in graduate school at MIT?
He had finished and was doing a postdoc while I got my degree. And I have to say, the whole experience was, looking back on it now, it was extremely stressful. We commuted in from the suburbs where we were living, and you know, we had my mother-in-law taking care of our children. I don't really want to go into that. You can sort of guess. But anyway, you know, I just worked like a dog. I mean, I worked from 9 in the morning till midnight every day. And
did you work with good people?
My major professor was a very distinguished neuroanatomist who put me on this extremely dull project and really didn't pay very much attention to me. And the work that was most interesting to me was with a younger professor. So I really did two projects at the same time, because this was in neural development, which I found very interesting. So in my third year, and most people take, you know, like 6 years or so to get a PhD. In my third year, I said to my husband, he's my ex-husband now, but we were married certainly at the time, and I said, if I have to work on this stupid project one more year, I'll lose my mind. I'm finishing in a year and we're getting out of here. So I finished in 4 years, starting from zero. I knew nothing about the nervous system, absolutely nothing. And, you know, I did have to take some courses and things that I really was unfamiliar with, like computer science and molecular biology. Anyway, somehow or other, I fumbled my way through and got my degree.
Very impressive.
And so, literally the day after I defended my thesis, we were in our moving van coming out here, because Ron had gotten a job as an assistant professor. And I noticed one of your questions is, why did you come here? Did I have a choice? So they sort of fixed up a postdoc for me here, but in point of fact, I pretty much worked by myself and decided on the project and got the money for the project and kind of did it.
What was the project?
Oh, it's really not important. I'm not doing that sort of work anymore. Okay. So, but actually, I had also started to work on development, which is my area now. And in terms of getting a job here, there were no women in this department, except for, there was one woman on a sort of sidetrack, was not, you know, medical students or anything, it was occupational therapy or, you know, one of those, shall we say, parallel tracks.
I see.
And I was actually offered something like that, and I just said no. You know, if I'm going to have a position, it's going to be a regular position,
sure,
not teaching occupational therapists or something like that. I mean, I knew it was second rate, and that they were, you know, trying to foist it off on me because I was a woman, and I was perfectly well aware of that, and I wasn't having any. So I just said no, and then a position opened up teaching, of all things, gross anatomy, about which I knew absolutely nothing. And so I said, well, how about if I applied for that? And I said, well, we suggest you actually take the course, you know, before thinking you were going to teach it. I said, oh, yeah, that, okay. So I took it with the medical students, and it was really, you know, very hard for somebody that had no background in human anatomy or physiology or anything. I mean, I really knew from nothing, and I was also, had never seen a dead body before and was terrified of what was lurking in the tank. Anyway, so I took the course, and I didn't realize until the last week of the course that I was expected to take the final exam with the medical students. And your entire grade was based on this final exam. And you know, I sort of had this attitude of, well, okay, I'll work away, but you know, wasn't taking it hugely seriously because you know, I was working on my postdoctoral projects and also developing some other areas of research interest. They gave me a little closet for a lab that I just, you know, outfitted as best I could. So I recall the week before this exam, I literally stayed up like practically all day and all night cramming the entire semester of gross anatomy into a couple of days, and managed to get a B. So, and the other thing that happened, this was right before they were going to make a decision about whether to hire me as an assistant professor, and I had also applied for an NSF grant, that's from the National Science Foundation, which you probably know. And the day before they were going to make the decision about whether to hire me, my grant came in. I got my grant. So, you know, getting a B in the course and getting my grant, because of course I knew that I was not going to spend most of my time teaching. That was just a requirement for the position. I knew that I wanted to be a researcher, but also I realized very early on that being on a non-tenure track, things that women very easily then and even now get sidetracked into, you know, like permanent research associate, I knew that was completely nowhere. So I was very adamant about getting an independent position that would allow me to do research, apply for funds, and so forth. So,
so did you compete for the position, or you had to be interviewed? You got your B and you got your grant.
Oh, they interviewed some other people, but you know, I think I was like so way better than them. It wasn't even close. I mean, at that time they often hired people to teach gross anatomy who were really not going to be researchers. You know.
But this was a full-time. This was a full-time faculty position, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. No question. So I had my NSF grant, and then I started developing this other project on neural development, and then I successfully wrote my NIH grant, and that was in 1978, and I have the same grant. I have renewed it for the last 30 years, almost. Not quite, you know, 26 years or something. So, again, I mean, most of the people in the department had much lighter teaching loads than I did. I started out teaching the entire gross anatomy course.
And what did that entail? It's all medical students.
It's all medical students. It was 3 hours a day, 9 to 12, and sometimes teaching independent study students in the afternoon, running my lab, having two grants, having two children, and then my husband decided he had another agenda. We won't go any further than that, and just decided that's what he was going to do. So, on top of all that, then I was a single mother. So,
I'm almost afraid. Did you have any, talk about the tenure process.
I worked like a dog, that's all I'm going to say. And after a while, because some of us, another person was hired who was more of a researcher, and we kind of protested about the backbreaking teaching load. I mean, there were people who were, you know, like my former husband taught like 10 lectures. That was his entire job. And I was teaching like, you know, all the time, plus having a lab, plus having graduate students.
How many years did you teach that class?
10 years. And I mean, now when new people come in, they don't even teach that. They don't even teach anything their first couple of years. I mean, everything is really different, and I very strongly believe in that, and I don't have this attitude, well, I suffered, and damn it, you know, you're gonna have to suffer too. I really feel very strongly that, you know. So I published, I got my grants, I did my teaching, I did everything that I was supposed to do, and I thought actually quite well. I thought that it was, within the department, being the only woman was somewhat isolating, you know. I really had nobody to talk to, and talk about mentoring, like, nobody ever told me anything. I had no committee, no nothing. And I think I'm very, very happy that that has changed for women. Plus, our chairman at the time when I was getting tenure. Don't get me started. Just horrible. Totally unsympathetic, unsupportive, awful person. So, my current chair got the position right the year that I got tenure, 1982. And there were no extensions, no nothing for women. And actually, it's probably just as well. I don't think these extended tenure clocks I think for having children, okay, or major catastrophes in your life, okay. But it's not, in science, it's not particularly helpful to string that out and kind of, in a sense, get off track with your peers and your male compatriots. So, and there were still no, there were no women in this department until I'd been on the faculty for 15 years. So now we have more in the last 5 or 6 years, but really the medical school is pretty much like that.
So the culture has changed in this department?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think as everybody points out, when for any gender or race or anything that's in the minority, everything changes when there's sort of a critical mass. But you know, people coming in then were assistant professors. They were not, you know, my peers mm-hmm. at all in terms of, you know, the time when we were hired. So
have you worked here in this building, in this office?
Not in this office.
But in this building?
We moved around a little bit. Yes.
And your lab is next door?
My lab is here, and then I have more space over there.
Would you talk about your research?
Sure. Basically, in a simple way, I work on how neurons, which are nerve cells in the brain or the spinal cord, make their connections with other brain cells during development. And they send out these long processes, which are called axons, and they have, I think if you looked at my website, you can watch the movies of mm-hmm. growth cones, and okay, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. That's what we study, some of the intracellular events that allow these motile growth cones to find their targets in the nervous system. And I mostly work in tissue culture, you know, isolated nerve cells. I don't work on it in the animal, although I used to.
And what is it that what is it about your research that has made NIH give you funding for 30 years? I mean, that's great.
I guess that I would say that it has moved ahead constantly with the times, and I've been on many study sections, and I think some people just kind of run out of steam and stop developing new techniques. And I think that technically, in terms of the kind of microscopy and live cell imaging that we do, and I don't know whether you've looked at any of that on the website. You can play the movies very easily.
I did look at it, but I have to tell you that I'm not good at science. So.
Well, I don't think you have to be in order to appreciate the visual impact.
That's true.
That makes. And so we got actually to be, I think, very much in the forefront of neural imaging, brain cells or brain preparations with high resolution digital imaging. And I think, I guess I would say the significance of the question, the technical expertise, which was developed by many of my graduate students. I mean, in this area, you don't get in there and do it all by yourself. But we have kind of continued to move forward where the research took us, rather than saying, well, oh, I don't know how to do that. You know, we would just figure out how to do it. And I've learned, I mean, I certainly didn't start out as a cell and molecular biologist, but have evolved over the years. And I do think the ability to continually learn and grow constantly has been a big help. And going back to my training, I would say the other strong point is, and I'm only saying this because I've been told many times by study section that my grants are extremely well written. They're always very clear, organized. In fact, my last review, somebody said, you know, this grant is beautifully written and a delight to read. And I, having been on study sections, most grants are hardly a delight. They're usually a chore. So I think that if you were able to write clearly so that what you're doing is understandable and persuasive. I always tell my students, the name of the game is tell me in 25 pages or less why you should give me $1 million. That's it in a nutshell. And I think, you know, our papers have always appeared in good journals, I think for a very similar reason. You know, the work is good, but also people are persuaded because, you know, I guess after all these years I can admit that I probably write better than many other people. I'll just say that much.
When I look at your website, and I've looked at other websites of scientists on campus, and I hear you talk, and you always say, we, it almost sounds like your team is almost like a family. How do you develop that team? I mean, how do you find your students, and how does it come together so that everybody works so well?
That's an interesting question. Usually, I mean, students find you. They apply to the program, and, you know, they sometimes do. I think to me that's one of the things that's so much more interesting than had I stayed in English literature. You know, you're the lonely scholar working away, you know. And I certainly don't have an enormous lab by many standards. I have had as many as 9 or 10. Right now I have 3 or 4, so. But I do think it's the job of the, you know, the leader, me, to really motivate people and to also to nurture them and to pay attention to them. And, you know, I really do look out after students. And I have to say that I have earned a good reputation as a good trainer over the years. And in point of fact, in our program, the neuroscience training program, I think I've trained more students than any other person on the training committee. And my students all do very well because I don't permit anything else. One of my students just got tenure, and another of my students just is coming back in September as an assistant professor after, you know, they did postdocs. And my students did not drop out. They all went on and pursued scientific careers, and I'm very proud of that.
Is there a good number of women that are in the
field? Oh, I'm sure. You know something? People ask me that, and I have to actually count. It's not something I pay any attention to. I treat men and women exactly the same, and sometimes people have said, well, how many women do you have in your lab? I go, well, let me see. And I have to, how many is that? And it's always been about 50-50.
Oh, that's good.
And I treat everybody the same. I don't think there should be any difference at all.
Yeah. And I didn't mean it as a question of how they're treated. It's just, when you said you came there, you were the only woman, and I just wondered if that's changed over the years, if there are more women going into this profession, into this field.
Well, there are more women graduate students, which doesn't, as you probably know, doesn't always translate to an equivalent number of faculty. And of course, as you go up the ranks because of history, I think the number of full professors who are women is pretty low. I mean, you can look those numbers up yourself. I don't know what that is, but.
Is collaborative work something that is encouraged in your department on this campus? I'm sure nationally, are you involved in a lot of collaborative work?
I have collaborated with people over the years. Maybe I should say something about this now. You may not be aware, but I was an associate vice chancellor for 3 years, from 1996 to 1999. And This is going to be archived, I can say this. I was completely responsible for the cluster hiring initiative. That was my thing. Of course, David Ward takes credit for it, you know, John Wiley takes credit for it. And that's probably as it should be, you know, their leadership, although I had to do some persuading to get them on board. In my opinion, it's been a very successful program, and I'm only bringing it up because you asked me whether I believe in collaboration. I believe in it so much, I think that I changed the culture of the campus to some degree.
Talk about it a little more. How did you get it going? How did you convince the rest of these people that this was important?
Well, because I belong to an interdisciplinary program, and I realized how difficult it was to do recruiting in any coherent way. Departments can recruit, programs can't. The other thing that was sort of a formative experience was I was on the Hearn Committee, which sort of had made a blueprint for biology. This was in early 90s, and we identified a number of problems in biology, which was, you know, hiring people that could work with other people, you know, building interdisciplinary research buildings, which has all now come to pass. And I actually wrote the report that came out of that. It was 2 years of work, and I distilled it into 15 pages so people would actually read it. And Donna Shalala thought it was great. And it's very rewarding to me that of many of the recommendations, you know, that we as a committee recommended and I put into a coherent form, actually came to pass. And the ability to hire interdisciplinary type people in the sciences was one of those things. So, you know, I'd been sort of thinking about it for a long time, and then when I got the position as Associate Vice Chancellor, part of it was to, I forget what the words were, something like reorganize biology on campus. So I said, well, we should do some of these things that, you know, I've been thinking about for a long time, you know, be able to do interdisciplinary hiring and so forth. And I remember John Wiley saying to me, well, you know, this really won't be a credible plan unless you organize it for the entire campus. And I said, well, I know all that liberal arts stuff. I can do that. I'm trained in that, you know. So I remember his saying to me, well, you can try, but, you know, the deans are never going to go for this. So what I did was to go around to each of the deans and persuade them that even though it would sort of cost them, you know, a small amount of their resources that were from their own schools, that in the end they would gain from this. And it turned out like way, I don't know if you know anything about it, but
I do.
In the event, it turned out way better than anybody thought it was. And of course now, you know, people are having whole positions to just tinker with it. And so the first year, you know, was a question of, okay, write us a plan. And I just behaved like it was a study section and people were writing me, you know, small little proposals. And the original memo that went out, I always believe from my English training, short is best. So the whole plan was 2 pages. I thought, people aren't going to read anything if you, some big tome, you know, this is just a waste of everybody's time. And I insisted that the pre-proposals be no more than a page. Then we picked from that and then had people write, you know, fuller proposals. And the first year, again, I don't think this is for public consumption, but basically, John Wiley gave me the whole pile. It was 96 and said, you pick. So, you know, I basically made the decision, but then I had to go and, you know, defend my choices to John and David Ward. And I think the thing that really helped was somewhere in the middle of all of this, the governor heard about this, somebody told him about this, and there was a big push then in genomics. He gave the university 8 positions in biology, like right in the middle of the year. I don't know if you
remember. I remember it.
So people were kind of impressed by that. Like, and I said, look, you get money when you have an idea, when you have a plan, and you tell people what you're going to do. So, I mean, after that, of course, they had a committee and so forth. But so I have to say, but I really was responsible for that. I don't like to brag about it, but I was very proud of it. And I mean, our department alone, my chair had never hired in any way except on a very parochial, what does our department need, you know, in terms of teaching, which is an extremely dull way to hire. So he got out there and got on these interdisciplinary committees, and eventually we were able to hire 6 people who had appointments in anatomy. The entire stem cell group is in the anatomy department, like Jamie Thompson, Clive Svensson. We had a zebrafish group, that was another initiative, so my former student has a joint appointment in zoology and anatomy. Never happened before. It's been the 30 years I've been here. Then we had a biophotonics group, and so my colleague next door was hired under that. So it transformed our department, I have to say. And
is it continuing?
Oh yeah,
that's what I thought.
It's just definitely continuing. I mean, they had some funding problems because there were a lot of sort of heavy-duty science things that they were supporting, but initiatives that had never happened on this campus before, like nanotechnology, and then they would hire cluster of 3 that they got from the school, from the university, then they would on their own augment it. All these interdisciplinary biology buildings that are going up now, I have to say, I'm not taking personal credit, but I think it grew out of this whole culture change in the university. And it pointed out something which I've known for a long time. You don't have to have 100% happen in this way, but even a small, you know, because people would say, oh, well, you know, you're only going to, this is a drop in the bucket compared with how many people there are on faculty. They've already hired 150 people under this plan who have brought in millions and millions of dollars, developed new courses, got funding for new buildings, written big collaborative grants. Everything that I said was going to happen has happened, like, way better than anybody thought. So I have to tell you, that was my big deal that I did, and I always really wanted to keep my research going, and so for me, 3 years was plenty. Got the job done, and then you do one big thing, and before you can make a complete fool of yourself, you leave.
So what you're saying is you're probably not interested in top-level administrative positions?
I had a number of headhunters come after me after this, and I know John Wiley told me he was getting calls from all over the country, how did you do this? And, well, I mean, even the La Follette School, which wanted to have an international initiative but never was able to do it because they couldn't hire people. I loved their plan. I said, you know, you're in. They hired people, and I know that person who was the head of it, his name escapes me, said, you know, you've changed the direction of our institute.
Several people I've interviewed have talked about the cluster hiring.
No kidding.
Very positive.
So I'm not making up this
you're
stuff.
You're not making it up at all. No. That's just great. Well, and I did not know that. I knew you were an associate vice chancellor, but I did not know that you got this all started.
Well, I know it's immodest to toot your own horn, but I really
am
very...
On campus, it's not.
I'm very proud of this, and I think most people who were there would acknowledge, although, of course, later in print, you know, this is David Ward's plan. You know, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, it was a big deal and is a big deal. Congratulations.
Well, it really has brought a lot of new funding and new ideas to campus.
Yeah.
And I just think sometimes these administrative positions, people don't, I think they can be in those positions for a number of years and not really leave any traces of anything interesting. And I think that the reason that this was possible is I didn't have a list of things I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, John Wiley gave me a lot of flexibility. He said, in essence, go do something interesting and then, you know, tell me about it. Well, okay.
So did you know walking in that is one of the things you wanted to try
well,
to get done?
Well, the name of the job was Collaboration and Reorganization
right.
in the Biological Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was defined.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the two other finalists were quite prominent biologists on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy that they gave it to me.
Well, I'm sure most of the campuses, too, or all of the campus.
But, you know, I mean, subsequent to that, I've gotten a number of calls, and I have gone out to look at administrative jobs, and I decided in the event this was really not what I wanted to do. And fortunately, I think sometimes also what happens to people in these jobs, they don't keep their labs going strongly, and so things tend to kind of fall apart, and then they don't have any other choice except to keep going in some administrative track. And I was absolutely adamant that that wasn't going to happen. And I had graduate students anyway, so.
I so really, research is your first love.
Absolutely, but I think that having a strong commitment to research really helped me make that initiative come to fruition, because I think many administrators get so far away from, you know, really any kind of scholarly enterprise. They get caught up in all this other crap, if I can say that on tape, and they just kind of lose track of what's important and why there's a university here anyway. You know, I don't have to worry about state budgets and all that other nonsense. So, and I think the other thing is when you come from a field in which having a good idea is the whole ball of wax, you don't discount ideas and you don't start thinking that everything is about process. I mean, and people tried to tell me about why it wouldn't work and the process. And the, I said, you know, forget about the process. Who cares? You know, and like for the first year, you know, they were talking about who's going to be on the committee. And there were people who were telling me, well, they all have to be in the National Academy. And I just said, oh, get out. And then I finally solved the problem by saying, forget the committee. Give me the pile. I can pick the best things out. I can pick the best 12 things out of here. You know, that's what I used to do all the time on study section. I know how to do that. So fortunately, John Wiley kind of believed that. And I also said sometimes it it's better, at least at the beginning, if one person who has a firm idea of what it's supposed to be all about makes the decisions from, you know, a sort of global point of view, it's a lot better than some committee who doesn't really understand what the enterprise is supposed to be about. So I think actually that was very helpful in seeing that it got off to a good start. Instead of having some big ego committee, each one of whom thought that they really knew what was going on, you know, it would degenerate into a process. Just get rid of the process. Go with the idea. That was my thought.
Well, good for you. You talked about your teaching of that gross anatomy class. Do you do any classroom teaching now?
I do none. And I'll tell you what happened. Right after I got tenure, NIH had started awarding me, I didn't even know about it, these special 7-year grants. If you got a very high score and they thought your work was really good, they were called Jacob Javits Neuroscience Investigator Awards, and I got one of the very first ones. And what they did was give you 7 years of support. You know, you didn't have to write a renewal or anything. And also at the same time, I had applied for a career development award, but they said, oh, you know, these are supposed to be for more established investigator, and a career development is not consistent with that, so you're not eligible for that, even though I'd gotten a very high priority score. And so I said, well, you know, I really need that because I've got to buy my way out of this heavy teaching load. And I had a wonderful program officer who said, now, Dr. He was a Southerner, he said, Dr. Kalia, don't you worry about that. We're going to take good care of you. What they did was they paid 80% of my salary for 7 years, which was better than this career development, which had a cap and only paid 5 years. So I said, okay, goodbye. Here's my money. I'm out of here. So that was really great.
But the teaching that you do in your lab with your individual students,
yeah,
in the group, that's...
I train students is right. What I do.
Right.
And I don't feel guilty about this because I support my department with my contribution to salary, which is pretty hefty, and it enables them to hire lecturers whose specialty is teaching gross anatomy, which they do extraordinarily well, way better than I could ever do it, and so everybody's happy. It works out very well. And this is not the sort of teaching that's in any way intellectually interesting. It's just a service course for medical students, basically. I think it's obviously important, but not something I choose to do. Now they bring in, you know, like people like, you know, I was telling you about this young professor who was hired in this biophotonics cluster. I mean, they would never ask him to teach gross anatomy. But I changed that culture too, in a sense, in the department by saying, you should not be asking researchers to do this.
You talked about enjoying writing, teaching your students how to write well. Is that a part of your job, that you enjoy the whole publication process?
Yes, I believe I'm always encouraging students to get their work to a publishable point, because if it's not published, it doesn't exist. And I know grant writing can be excruciating, but I kind of enjoy it almost as a challenge. So, you know, I rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, but
your funding's never been in jeopardy, although you really can't depend
on it. Oh, it's always
that.
In jeopardy.
It is, okay.
Always, always. I mean, the priority scores now, the percentile they're funding like maybe the top 10 or 12% at NIH. And to be competitive for decades on end, I am telling you, you're always in jeopardy.
I see.
And you know, I've got another, I have another grant as well from a foundation. And you know, on a few occasions I've had to resubmit my grant, you know, because it doesn't get it on the first try, but I don't think that's going to be a big deal over 30 years. It takes a lot of work to be, you know, to stay, you know, at the forefront of your field for this long. And, you know, many people just don't. They run out of steam. But I really like it, and, you know, for me, that's sort of my job. And when I'm not able to fund my lab anymore, I'm going to just steal away into the night. You know, I have no other reason to be here.
I'm going to switch direction a little bit here. You talked about your success as Associate Vice Chancellor. Have you been involved in other faculty governance committee work or other campus activities that you'd like to talk about?
I have been on every major committee there's to be on. I was on the first on the Graduate Fellowships Committee, then on the Research Committee, you know, that gives out internal funding from the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And again, I was shocked. I walked into the room. There were 19 men and me, and I just was flabbergasted. And this was all fields. Mm. You know, humanities, social sciences, physical sciences, biological sciences. And I thought, what is with this place? By that time, you know, I had tenure, and I just was pretty floored. And so that committee, and I was on the Hearn committee, and I was on the, you know, BISPAG, Biological Sciences Advisory Committee. I was on the tenure committee. I mean, yeah. The whole, you
right.
know,
right.
The whole gamut, I would say.
Well, your comment on the research committee leads right into the next questions. Discuss the climate for women here. How does it help and or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
I would say it certainly improved a lot since I've been here. I would say at the beginning, I really did not get any support from anybody. I mean, I was, sometimes I look back and I think, you know, we're always so, I mean, we have mentoring committees and, you know, me to pay attention. I had nothing. And, you know, I've heard people complain, oh, you know, I wasn't successful because I didn't get any mentoring. Cry me a river. You know, nobody told me how to write a grant or what to do or anything about anything. All I knew is that, you know, you had to go and get your funding and write your papers. And I don't know, looking back, I guess it was just a phenomenal single-mindedness that, I don't think the medical school is a very welcoming place for women at all, and I will say it has improved a lot. But I will also say that I think that this campus talks a better talk than they actually, you know, put out for women. I mean, yes, there are things that were never existed when I was starting out. You know, it was too late anyway in terms of special leave, childcare, whatever, all these things have only come about in the last 10 years. So they were just irrelevant to me. I guess in a way, I really didn't think a whole lot about, and I still don't. I'm not a woman in science. I am a scientist, period. And I just think, to me, it's patronizing to say, you know, woman in science. Like, oh, you poor thing, you need some special consideration or something. I just felt like I was out there doing my job just like anybody else. Although certainly at the time, I think to succeed as a woman, you probably had to be better than everybody else.
Do you think that, or I guess I'll put it this way, what about for girls in elementary school, high school? You know, there's this push to make sure that girls get trained in science and that if they want to go into that career, that type of a career, that it's available to them. Do you think that's a problem anymore?
No. You know where I think the real problem comes, and I've read study after study, I think it comes later. You know, like, we're not doing badly. Over half of the women in graduate school in biology are women. And you really can't expect to do any better than that. You know, we're represented according to our numbers. In fact, better. I think the problems come later. And a lot of studies have borne this out, that graduate school is fine, maybe the postdoc is fine, and then with, you know, getting the job and pushing through to tenure right at the time, you know, when women are having children, is still a big problem. And I think that some women are opting out after the postdoc because they think that there are too many sacrifices, it's too hard, it's too much, you know, it's too much. So I don't think the problem is back in elementary school. I think it's later when women have most of the responsibilities.
And it's not easy to get back to
you can't go away and come back. It's not possible. You have to just push through the difficult years. I mean, on the other hand, okay, like, I'm divorced, so I guess, like, you can't say I'm some big success story. I don't think that was any of my doing, but what can I say? Maybe if I had been a little more retiring and not so, you know, but I felt that I always did my job and took care of my house and took care of my children and did all the cooking and all the cleaning and all the yard work, and I don't know what more I was supposed to do. What can I say to that?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I'm talk about my children who are just the
talk about
absolute light of my life.
Okay, tell me all about them.
They're so accomplished. They've always been so good. They're both, well, my criteria are happily married and gainfully employed. My son, they both went here. My son had a triple major in political science and economics and I don't know, something else. And then he got a master's degree at Tufts and then went into government and wound up as a member of Clinton's National Economic Council and, you know, was in the Clinton administration for 8 years and just did fabulously
now
well.
What's his name?
Tom Khalil. He actually was on the front page of the local paper at one point. Local boy makes good. I always say I'm the slacker in my family. So he's married and has two children, so I have four grandchildren.
Does he live in Washington?
No. He, after Clinton was over, he's a Democrat, of course. And so he went out to Berkeley, where he works to sort of coordinate and he's working in interdisciplinary research. He organizes these big science and technology centers out at Berkeley, and just is a really smart guy, and gets people together to write big collaborative grants, and has all kinds of consulting jobs, and
think he'll ever go into politics?
Knows everybody, and there are pictures of him with Bill Clinton, and Al Gore calls him up, and he gets some little consulting jobs from time to time, and I think if the Democrats come back to Washington, once Bush gets out of here, I could see that he might want to do that. They really like living near Berkeley a lot. But and my children, I think, really still love their mommy, which is, sometimes I feel like, oh, I neglected you guys. And so my daughter, she just got tenure on the faculty at the University of Chicago. She's in public policy. First person in 7 years to get tenure after 4.5 years and 2 children. She makes me look like toast,
And what's her name?
Ariel Khalil.
And you have 4 grandchildren.
I have 4 grandchildren.
Talk about them.
What can I say? They're cute, they're smart, they're fabulous.
How old are they?
6 and 3 is my sons, and my daughters are 4 and 2.
Girls and boys?
Each has a girl and each has a boy. And I am so proud of them. And
do you get to see them?
Yeah, my daughter lives in Chicago,
oh, yeah,
so I go there from fairly often. And I've taken her to a lot of meetings, so she knows a lot of my colleagues. And sometimes she comes with me on trips. So actually, I have a meeting in Australia. I've organized a symposium this next summer. So I said, well, Ariel, any chance you might like to come with me to Australia? let me look into that. So she might do that. But we're really very close, and she, she's got it all. She's got a great husband. She's very successful at her career. Has multiple grants, big lab, travels all the time. What more could anybody want? And she's not one of these like hard bitten kind of, she's a human being, which I've tried to be over the years. I consider that, plus training good students, to be, to me, the major achievements of my life, outside of science.
And what do you do for fun and relaxation?
Okay, you know what really helps? I'm 65. And I've never taken one single day of sick leave in my entire life. I've got a pile of sick leave hours. I don't even know how much it is. But I've always felt that I have the constitution of an ox. I'm never sick, knock wood. I have, do not have health problems. So for fun, I have 2 miniature poodles that I walk a lot, and are totally cute and fun and adorable. And I have a horse, and I ride competitive dressage.
Oh, good for
I
you.
Have a trainer, and try to ride a couple of times a week.
Do you live in the country?
No, I live in Shorewood, actually. Okay.
Where do you keep your horse?
Out in the country, near Black Earth.
Okay.
and he's a champion dressage horse, and one day I'll ride up to his level. But so he's great, and I totally enjoy it.
Now, do you find time for friends?
Yes, I do have friends, which I consider to be important. In fact, I belong to a group of women who I've gotten to know over the past 10 years because people like Martha Casey were in Bascom, and I know that she told me that she recommended me to talk to you, so she's been really a great friend. And I have women colleagues, you know, in other places too that I don't see so often, but I see at meetings. And you know, I do get to, one of the great things about science is that it's international, so you know, I get to travel, and I just came back from Stockholm, a very nice meeting, and I used to travel and give talks a lot, almost every month, and I do that a little less now.
And do you try to add some time on?
Yes. Yes. It's exactly what I do. Yeah. I added 5 or 6 days onto my Stockholm, so I got to, you know, walk around, see the city, enjoy it. I also recently bought a condominium in Florida, so I have a warm place in future if I ever retire.
Where in Florida?
On Longboat Key near Sarasota.
Oh, how nice.
So it's been a lot of fun because I invite my children and grandchildren to come for Christmas and spring break. So that's just been the last couple of years. So.
And now you said earlier you're organizing this symposium for Australia next summer?
Well, it's part of a big international meeting, but I was asked to organize a symposium, so I got in touch with, you know, 3 other colleagues to put this thing together, so, and I'll be one of the speakers.
Well, it sounds like you have a well-balanced life.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to have a partner, but what are you gonna do?
Well, you've got a lot of other things in your life, that's for sure.
Yes, I feel that, and I've always felt that being a faculty member at a, you know, a good university like this, and especially with the freedom to be creative and essentially do whatever you want, whenever you want, which is essentially my job, is an extraordinary privilege, which I am very mindful of and I don't take for granted. It's really, you know, I really do appreciate it. I'm not one of these whiners.
No, I can see that.
And I think it's just a great opportunity. I think you have to work hard at it, but it's very rewarding. And you know, when people sort of say, oh, I can't wait to retire. Well, why am I not thinking like this? I have 4 more years of funding at this point. And actually the foundation where I have one of my grants called me up this morning and said, when are you going to send in your renewal? Of course, NIH never asks you that. They just sort of go away. We don't need to read anymore. You know, they're inviting me to renew my grant. So I thought, well, you know, why not?
Right.
We're doing well, and, you know, I think that we have a reasonable chance of success. You know, so nobody yet has treated me like, when are you leaving?
Well, that's the end of my questions. This was a great interview. If there's anything else you want to add before we turn off the recorder, please do.
Well, I guess I would say I don't want to sound like Pollyanna, like, oh, look at me, I'm so great, my life is so perfect. You know, it's not like that. And I would say that, you know, I've had my ups and downs over the years, and there certainly have been times of, you know, struggle and so forth. But I feel at this point in my life, I feel very lucky to be able to look back and feel, you know, good about my career and my life, and the feeling that by luck, luck of the draw, you know, my children have just turned out to be so very wonderful, and I never had any feeling of having, I think it's terrible for women these days to make a choice between having a career or family, and I think that's a very bitter choice that I wouldn't advise anybody to have to make. I mean, everybody can decide if they want to have children or not, but if they do, I think it's terrible for women to feel, well, if I want to have a career, I can't have children. I do, you know, I do think that it's possible and desirable. And it does give you a sense of balance and perspective. You know, when you're going nutso because somebody didn't accept your paper or invite you to something, you know, you go home and you get real with your family, and that's really important. So that's why, that's how I would conclude.
Great way to end this. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.